In August of this year, the Council of Ministers of the Supreme Soviet promulgated a new regulation which they numbered 572, in which they entitled a tariff for the reimbursement of education. The tariff set out various sums of money that would have to be repaid to the USSR, the Soviet state, by anyone with a college diploma or even a high school certification who wanted to renounce his Soviet citizenship to emigrate from the Soviet Union. These sums would be in addition to the now present and active tariff of about $1,000. 500 rubles, which a man or woman or child must pay in order to get an exit permit. 400 rubles, which anyone must pay in order to renounce his citizenship. $1,000, of course, is very difficult to save in a socialist state. The kinds of monies required by the new tariff of payment are incredible and impossible. A person who has an ordinary baccalaureate, an AB degree, must pay on an average of 7,800 rubles, about $9,500. And if you are unlucky enough to have a PhD in the advanced sciences, physics, chemistry, you must pay a sum equivalent to some $25,000. Now, these sums are unattainable within the Soviet Union, and this tariff is not really a statement of an ordinary tax on emigrants. Repayment for the obvious fact that their education has been paid for by the state, but it is a form of economic blackmail to staunch the emigration of peoples, particularly of Jews, preeminently of Jews, only of Jews, from the Soviet Union. It is dressed up, this form of blackmail. Dressed up to seem appropriate, understandable. The Soviet has great concern for what it will be thought of in the outside world. And it is true that unlike the United States, where advanced education is a private enterprise function, that the state does pay all costs of one's advanced education. But if the Soviet were truly concerned with repayment in service, in years of service for one's education, then surely there would be some indication in these tables that a man who has done research, taught for 40 years, has long since repaid his obligation. There would be a higher tariff for the last year's graduate than for this man who has served a lifetime. But the tariff is one and the same for both. What the Soviets were concerned about was the staunching of the increasing and the increasingly embarrassing emigration of Jews from Mother Russia. Until 1970, when the door had for the first time come a bit ajar, only a handful of Jews had been able to leave the Soviet. These largely to be reunited with families which had been broken up by the great movement of armies and population and dispersed peoples across Eastern Europe at the end of the Second World War. In 1971, despite innumerable bureaucratic obstacles, despite a very loud propaganda campaign, domestic campaign against immigration, despite the danger of losing one's job, of being thrown out of one's apartment, of having one's child enrollment in school canceled, 1,000 Jews a month found their way out of the Soviet Union. And the rate had increased to some 2,000 Jews a month through July of this year. And we are told that there may be as many as 250,000 men, women, and children, Jews, who would like to get out, who have either made application or who would make application if they thought there was any chance of their permit being granted. Now, the Soviet has been embarrassed and surprised by all of this. In the first instance, it's a dogma of the Soviet myth that life is better within the homeland than anywhere else. Who would want to leave the workers' paradise to be slave labor in some bourgeois capitalist state? And particularly, what Jew should want to leave the one major nation which has in its constitution a provision which specifically outlaws any act of anti-Semitism? Why should the Jews want to leave? And many have objected to their leaving, the Arab states particularly, because this brain drain, that is what it is, obviously contributes to the human resource, the wealth of Israel. But I suspect what has surprised these dialectic materialists the most, these economic theoreticians who believe that all problems are solved by economics, is the simple fact that the Jews of the Soviet Union have been well off by Soviet standards. And if you want a measure of this, you have simply to look at the instrument which they devised in order to staunch the emigration. An instrument which would be effective not against a group of peasants, not against a group of blue-collar workers, but only against a group, a large percentage of whom have won degrees, have earned advanced placement, and who now occupy, by virtue of these largely scientific and technical degrees, places of importance within the professional, engineering, and scientific hierarchies of the Soviet state. Why is it that a group of people who, by economic standards, are well off, why should this group particularly want to leave? And their desire to leave, besides going to the heart of the very theory on which the Soviet Union rests, embarrasses the Soviet Union and the international community in a number of ways, ways which at this moment in time they find to be embarrassing. In the first instance, their reaction, their surprise at the emigration has led to some rather clumsy, heavy-handed attempts to stop it. And there have been the show trials in Leningrad and in Moscow of those poor Jews of Riga who tried to commandeer a plane to have it fly them to Finland, of those young militant activist Jews in Moscow who began demonstrations in front of foreign embassies wherever they could gain attention. And the suppression of these activities, the harsh sentences sometimes given out at the show trials, have embarrassed the Soviet Union with her friends in the free world. The communist parties in Italy and in France particularly have sent letters of condemnation to the Soviet state because of these actions. And throughout the Soviet world, the radical world, these kinds of repressions have made a distance between the Soviet state and those who ought to be her natural allies in Latin America, in the United States, in Europe, and in Asia. And now that the Soviet has had a year with rather inadequate crops, and she needs a moment of cooling off within her campaign against the United States and the free world in order to digest her economic and political advances in the Middle East and the Indian subcontinent, now that she's beginning to talk of bilateral trade negotiations with the United States, hopefully on a most favored nation basis, she suddenly finds that her actions vis-a-vis these Jews, whom she doesn't quite understand, have led 76 senators to put a sense of the Senate rider to a trade bill saying that no further trade relations acts ought to be, or treaties ought to be signed between the United States and the Soviet Union until her acts of repression towards Jews have been voided. And until emigration is again possible, this kind of civic slavery which the Soviet Union has imposed has been removed. For many reasons, the Soviets have had reason both to be angered by this peculiar Jewish desire to leave and to be frustrated and to know how to deal with it. And so, though the act was apparently promulgated in August, it was never officially announced. And last week there were indications from Moscow that some families, some said 25, some said 40, we don't know the exact number, were being allowed to emigrate without payment of this tax. And apparently the more activists among the groups who are now coming out were called just Thursday of this week to the Interior Ministry, where some senior Soviet officials talked to them and said to them, tell the Jews of the world when you get out that anyone who wants to leave from the Soviet may leave. Obviously no one wants to leave, but of those who, we will keep only those who have sensitive jobs, some 7% of those who have up till now made application. And there the matter now stands. And only time, the vagaries, the complexities of international relationship, the pressure of, from within the Soviet Union by those who want to leave and from those without the Soviet Union who want to help them leave, only these will determine the size of the immigration, the duration of the emigration, and whether or whether or not it will be permitted at all. Rather than to talk this morning about strategies, what I'd like to do is to talk about the reasons that Jews have wanted to leave the Soviet Union. Because I think it's important for Jews outside the Soviet Union to be very clear on several points. The first is that Russia 1972 is not Germany of the 1930s. The Jews are citizens of the Soviet Union. The Jews are not non-persons. There is no official racial bias. There's a great deal of unofficial anti-Semitism. Russia has always been the center of a crude, rude anti-Semitic spirit. And many, obviously, of government officials share in that spirit. They're Russian. But anti-Semitism is forbidden by the Russian Constitution. And obviously, Jews would not have as many degrees as they do, have risen as high as they have in the various scientific and educational academies, if there had been serious quotas, restrictions on their entrance into the universities heretofore. Much of the danger that hangs over the heads of the Soviet Jew is not so much what has happened till now, but what may happen from this moment on. There are many indications that the Soviet has reacted not only by keeping Jews, now suspect, out of sensitive positions in the foreign ministry, in the highest echelons of the military, but they have been actively discriminating against young Jews who want to follow their fathers and their mothers into the technical schools and into the universities. But the condition is not the condition of Jews facing the sword. What the Jews face in the Soviet Union is something far more complex, far more emotional, far more psychological in its impact. Perhaps the best way to illustrate it to you is to tell you of some of those who have left or are leaving, and as far as I can, in their own words, have them describe to you what brought them to this point. Perhaps in this way we will understand this group of our fellow Jews and something about their world, and I hope in the end something about our own. By coincidence, one of the men who is coming out this week is a young 39-year-old computer researcher by the name of Roman Rotman. He's been an activist. He has demonstrated in front of embassies. He has been sentenced to jail for 15 days, 30 days for demonstrations, for sedition. He has been deprived of his apartment. But until he began in the last few years these activities, he was a graduate engineer with a PhD. He had published widely within his professional journals. He had a fine apartment. He had a fine car. He was established within the Soviet system. What leads Roman Rutman to emigrate? About 12 months ago, a Jew met Rutman in Moscow and published an interview with him when he returned in the Village Voice in New York. And what led Roman Rutman to want to leave was not 1967 and Israel's military success, and really not any reawakening of traditional interests in the God of Israel, but interestingly, Czechoslovakia, and his growing awareness of the inability of the Russian state to fulfill the mythic promise that its propaganda and its ideology had aroused in him and others like him who were first or second generation Russian-trained, communist-trained. What happened to Rutman is not unlike what happened to many of our own sons and daughters, who found not Czechoslovakia but Vietnam to be the breaking point in their affirmation of the American myth. From that moment on, the words seemed hypocritical: democracy, freedom, justice. They became political oratory, not part of the reality of the American system. It began, Rutman said, with Czechoslovakia. And at that time, when I began to protest with some other young Russians, I myself realized very deeply two things, and I'm quoting him. I realized that we had been lying to ourselves about the future all along, that Russia would never have more freedom than she has now. Her tradition has always been one of absolute power to the state. Her people have no tradition of being independent. They have always let themselves to be led by one tyrant or another. It is a need of theirs to have a strong government. We had thought that there were a great horde of intellectuals who shared our disgust with the savagery in Czechoslovakia. But when it came time to protest, all but seven or eight people fell back in silence. Around this time, many of my friends began to be baptized. There was a neo-Christian movement afoot, and I myself was on the brink of being baptized. But something held me back. I felt an irreparable separation, like the cold space that settles after two lovers have split apart. All my life, I had loved my country and then hated her, then loved her and then hated her again. Now I felt nothing for Russia. This was a new and very real vacuum in my life. I began to ask myself some larger questions. Perhaps you could call them religious questions. I began to think about a man's place in the universe in relation to the rest of mankind. Where does a man belong, and what should be the meaning of his life? More than political questions. Simply the way I reasoned was, a country is a community of people living in the same area of space. In that sense, I'm a Russian. But there are also communities in time, communities of traditions within history. And I realize that I really do not identify with Russian ancestors. I cannot honestly see myself as a figure in the stream of Russian history. I do not feel I belong to it. The Russian traditions are things I have been taught. They are not things I feel natural in myself. The great figures in Russian history are people I can admire but not identify with. They were moved by things that do not move me. I've always been treated as someone apart, being a Jew. Even though I knew nothing of the Jewish religion until recently, and I am not a religious person in the conventional sense, even though I have been, as I told you, successful, still I have always been regarded as a person of a lower order. I realized I had never been accepted as a Russian. I guess I always knew it, but tried to ignore it. But also I realize that I have never really been able to accept the culture of Russia as my own. So I have been studying something of Jewish history. From what I know, I think I can identify myself much more naturally in Jewish traditions. Anyway, I want to be with people I feel are my own. I think the Jews are my people. I know the Russians are not. I am no longer a participant in Russian society, and I feel very good about that. It is like suddenly telling the truth after a long, long time of acquiescing to a lie. Perhaps I'm all wrong. Perhaps in Israel I will feel the same alienation as I feel here, but I hope I will not. I suspect that Ruttmann's emotional hegira, spiritual journey, could be duplicated in the West by many of our sons and daughters, though he's a half a generation older than they. He's a man in his late 30s. But to Russia, the opportunity to feel, to react to freedom came late. It began only with Mr. Khrushchev's speech to the 20th Soviet about 15 years ago when he buried the Stalinist myth. And this whole generation of which Ruttmann is a part for the first time was tried to find the freedom which Khrushchev seemed to promise, ran up against Czechoslovakia, against the barrier, against the tyranny that is traditionally Russian, and because of the inevitable and sometimes rather obvious anti-Semitic acts which all of them had faced at some point in their history, they began to look for some other rootage. And they think they will find it within that other label that they bear on their passports, Hebrew, Jew. And as they well ask, will they find it when they leave and come among us? If our own children cannot find it with us, what will happen to a Ruttmann when he leaves the Soviet? But Ruttmann is not completely typical of all who are seek to leave. Last April, when I escorted some of the clergymen of Cleveland to Israel, we went down one night to Lida. The airport was deserted, dark. There were no commercial planes scheduled, only two charter flights from Vienna, bringing with them emigres from the Soviet Union. We were there somewhat early, maybe 11 o'clock. The flights weren't due till 1. The airport was quiet. And then about an hour later, a few good ladies from Ramat Gan bustled in, Ramat Gan's sisterhood, who brought cookies and tea and coffee and milk for the children. And a few officials came. Each of the refugees would be given the key to his own apartment. He'd sleep in his own quarters that night. A few coins so that they'd be able to buy the few immediate necessaries, their cards of identification. All this was handled with amazing dispatch. And we sat there and we talked to the good women and we talked to the bureaucracy of Israel and we joked a bit about the first sight on Israeli soil that these people would have would be men with the turned back collar. You know, what would they think? Where had they really come? And then the planes arrived. And most of the people who descended from the planes looked physically as we do. They were Jews of the West, of Russia, Polish Jews who'd been pushed into Russia during the Hitler days, Jews of Lithuania, Jews whose body type, whose languages were familiar to us, with whom one or another of us could communicate in Hebrew and Yiddish and Polish and Russian and German in some language. But there were a number of smaller men and women, smaller in stature, weather-beaten, somewhat grayer in skin, much smaller in physical stature, with whom none of us could communicate. They came from the far corners of Asia, from Tashkent and Uzbekistan, from places which we've heard of only if we've read Marco Polo. These were Jews who lived in a rural or small village environment, who lived very much as their fathers had lived for 100 generations. Their language, a mixture of Arabic and Persian and the immemorial language of the steppes. There was absolutely no communication possible between us and between them. Now, why had these people come to Israel? They knew nothing of Moscow. They'd never been there. They knew nothing of the show trials. They probably had heard of Israel only from their holy books. Why had they come, these medieval Jews, for medieval reasons? A little town called Margolan in Uzbekistan. You and I have probably never heard of it, but it had a community of some 8,000 Jews. And 2 days after Rosh Hashanah in 1961, 11 years ago, someone in Margolan brought a charge of ritual murder against a Jewish family in the town. A 2-year-old Muslim girl was missing. and the Jewish home was searched. It was claimed that her blood had been used in the Rosh Hashanah ritual. And for 7 days, the police stood apart and allowed the community of Margolan to be looted, burned, and the people there attacked. Here was galut, exile, the immemorial medieval experience of the Jew. And just a year later in Tashkent, which is one of the capitals of this area, a place where there were 50,000 Jews, a ruffian brought a charge of ritual murder, another charge against a 70-year-old Jewish storekeeper, a woman, and her house was ransacked, and no one complained, and she was thrown into jail simply on his charge. And for another week, the Jewish community of Tashkent was open to looting and to burning, and the Jew faced the immemorial hate, just as he had faced it for the same canards, the same libels which he had faced it for 1,000 years. Nothing had changed. This was not technological Russia, advanced Russia, Soviet Russia. This was the ancient hate, the hate of the medieval world. To the Jew of Tashkent, these were the Chevle HaMashiach, the birth pangs of the Messiah. And they had come to Israel because they could no longer live in a community which was as openly, as flagrantly anti-Semitic, where these old libels were openly spoken and where those who were in control of the community, in a sense, agreed by their passivity, by their inaction to the attack. They came to the Holy Land. Messianism brought them to that land. And they brought a medieval Jewishness to Israel. That same night, we were met by a woman, very much like many whom we know. She was about 50. She was as vivacious and vigorous as anyone I've ever met. She'd been born in Vilna. She'd been living in Riga. She had been raised before the Second World War in a Hebrew high school. Her Hebrew was absolutely fluent. She was typical of another generation who were coming to Israel, those who were swept into Russia in the 1940s. But who had been raised in the intensely Jewish environment of Eastern Europe before that time. She had met her husband when she was a partisan in Poland during the Second World War. He was an engineer. He was not from as Jewish a home as she, but he was fighting with the partisans. They fell in love. He was an engineer. He lost an arm, which had been cut off at the shoulder in the fighting. And after the war, they found themselves in Latvia. They settled in Riga. He became an engineer in a large company there. She became a correspondent for one of the local newspapers. They thought, well, the Nazis are behind us. We'll make a new life. But daily they were surrounded by evidence of rather flagrant anti-Semitic activity. She was eager to establish a Yiddish theatrical group in Riga. She'd been great. She was a real balabusta, you know, who would make anything work. But she went to the authorities, and the authorities don't have the love of balabustas that we do, and they turned her down. What do you want to bother with this kind of old-fashioned of Yiddish activity? And they'd met one indignity after another, and the crowning indignity was when their young daughter, who was, when I met her, about 21, when she was 16, she applied for the Bolshoi Ballet School, and in her interview, she was told, we can't take you, we have too many Yids, too many Jews already. And at that point, 7 years before, these people who had been deprived of their ancestral cultural heritage, because the Soviet, for all of its pretensions to accept the nationalism of the Jew, at least, has denied him the normal forms of schooling, of drama, of literature, of song. Because they had been denied this heritage, because they were surrounded by prejudice, they had made application. She had been thrown out of her job at the newspaper. She had worked for the last 5 years to hold the family together as a charwoman in the local theater. Her daughter had worked as a secretary in whatever job she could get. And finally, after 5 years of being spat upon and pushed from here to there by anyone who discovered that they were among the traitors to the Soviet, those who wanted to leave, it finally come, and she was 3 feet above ground. She was just so excited, she couldn't stop talking. Her dreams had been fulfilled. And there's one other kind of Jew who's leaving the Soviet Union. I met Mikhail Zahn for the first time at Brandeis a few months ago. He's a leading Orientalist, a man about my age. His father was a Polish communist in the 1910s and 1920s. His father had moved the family into Russia in the early 1920s to be part of the great Soviet experience. They settled in the town of Kamenets, and he had been a bureaucrat in the Communist Party of Kamenets for the first 10 or 15 years of Mikhail Zahn's life, until he was swept up in one of Stalin's purges. And the father never appeared again. He was murdered. And Mikhail Zahn and his mother had to move here and there, now branded as outcasts, as parias, because their father, the husband of the family, had been declared a traitor to the state. They found their way to Moscow, and they found their way from Moscow back into the Urals during the Second World War, where they worked as, where she worked as a school teacher to the children of coal miners. And somehow, moving from place to place, Zahn was called not only the son of a traitor, but the words son of a traitor and son of a Jew became equivalent terms to him. He learned to use his fists. He didn't know what a Jew was. His family couldn't give him any content to the term. But in the far reaches of the Urals, he came across a Soviet encyclopedia. And in that Soviet encyclopedia, written way back in the days of Lenin, before the Stalin trials, purges, and had come to the fore, there was an article about Yiddish. And he read that article, and he memorized the article. And in the article, there was the Hebrew alphabet. And he memorized the Hebrew alphabet. And then his life is one desperate search beyond the search for survival, to find books in Yiddish, in Hebrew. When he came out of the Soviet Union a year and a half ago, Mikhail Zahn spoke a perfect, fluent Hebrew. He spoke a perfect, fluent Yiddish. He had trained himself to be one of the leading Orientalists in the world, and he had devoted his learning to the communities of Uzbekistan and Tashkent with their strange Jewish communities, because the Soviet was interested in these communities and because it would give him a chance to touch Jewish life. And after 1967, when he had been pushed from here and there and denied certain kinds of appointments because of his background, because of his being Jewish, he became one of the small group of demonstrators in Moscow. He was sentenced at several trials to longer periods of time in jail. The West took up the cudgels for Mikhail Zahn. We heard about him, and all of a sudden, a number of Western universities made applications to the Soviet Council of Scientists to allow Zahn to leave to receive honorary degrees at Oxford, at the Hebrew Union College, and elsewhere. They couldn't bury the man. He couldn't simply disappear. So finally, a year and a half ago, he and his family were allowed to emigrate. Now, why have people left the Soviet Union? Mikhail Zahn and Hotman were men who had made their way academically and professionally to a satisfactory position. They could survive. They could provide for their families. Something was missing. They were not at peace. Always there's that element of insecurity, racism, the recognition that the Jid is something, someone who is different. And 1967, for many Jews, was a turning point. Let me read to you a paragraph written to the West by another Jew by the name of Ephraim Feinblum. Feinblum would be today 38 years of age. He's an electrical engineer. He was, again, one who had been able to take advantage of the Soviet system. And until 1967, being Jewish was really little more than a label that he bore on his passport. On the eve of the Six-Day War, Moscow opened its offensive propaganda against Israel. I was surprised by the internal contradictions and exaggerations of this propaganda. The author seemed to me accusing me of being a Jew. So I began to be interested in Soviet Middle Eastern policy. When I felt that I knew a good deal about it, I went as a party member to the Central Committee of the Communist Party and requested this policy be explained to me. That was 1969. I was told that I complained too much, and I ought to keep my mouth shut. At first, there were no consequences of my openly questioning talk. But after the show press conference of Jews in Moscow on March 4, 1970, I again wrote to the Central Committee expressing my thoughts about the Middle East in a 12-page letter and warning that this Moscow policy would encourage the development of anti-Semitism throughout the Soviet Union, which the Communist Party would be unable to control. This has already happened. I also stated I couldn't understand why Russian armed forces were stationed in Egypt. As a result of this letter, I was expelled from the party, and a meeting was summoned in the factory where I worked, at which, in my absence, the workers were told that I was guilty of Zionist thoughts. It's not religion. It's not even ideology. He remains a good, loyal member of the Communist Party till 1969. But it's rather the fact that when the Soviet heart and soul threw itself behind Egypt and the Arab cause in the 1960s, it unleashed within the Soviet Union not only anti-Israel propaganda, but that inevitable complement of anti-Israel propaganda, anti-Semitic activity. It was very easy to say, Israel is an outpost of the imperialist world. Israel is supported by a group of militants, Zionist, imperialist bourgeois, who are engaged in an international conspiracy against the freedom-loving peoples of the Arab world. Now, obviously, who are the members of this international conspiracy? Jews. And this includes Ephraim Feinblum, a Communist Party member in the Soviet Union. And every Jew in 1967 in the Soviet Union suddenly awoke to the fact that he was looked upon not only as comrade, but as comrade Jew, as a potential member of a conspiracy which his government declared to be not only heretical, but treasonous. 1967 was a great turning point in the internal history of Soviet Jewry. Men like Ephraim Feinblum, third generation young Jewish communists, wrong, third generation communists who happened to bear a title Jew on their passports, who otherwise have no other interest or awareness of this fact, are suddenly declared outcasts, outside the pale, different than. And they awaken to the fact that there is no security for them within a nation which supposedly has only an ideological test of one's loyalty to the state. Does one accept Russian communism or not? In many ways, if we're honest, what's happened to the Soviet Jew has parallels to so much that's happening in our own country. How often I hear people say, look at all the economic advance that has been made by the minority groups. The rate of income of black families has risen twice as fast in the last decade as the rate of income of white families. What more do they want? Why aren't they satisfied? Well, in America, we've seen the black and the Indian and the Mexican-American try to satisfy the other hunger, which is within the human soul. His need to be himself, to have dignity, to have a sense of the worth of his own culture, of his own inheritance, to recognize that if racism is endemic in the society, he must, in defense, create a counter-society where he is seen just for himself, just as a man. And racism in Europe is spelled anti-Semitism. And in the Soviet Union, despite all of the economic opportunities which the Jew had, obviously, over the last 30 years, forgetting now the repression and forgetting all that Stalin represents, despite all that the Jew has had, he still has recognized deep within his soul that he's not accepted. He's needed something more, a sense of self-worth. And the Russians have denied this to him by starving the content of his nationality. If they had Sechel, the Russians would have allowed the Yiddish theater to develop. If they had Sechel, they would have allowed Yiddish press besides the Quisling press to develop, Jewish literature. They would have allowed luachs to be printed. They'd have allowed the yeshiva to remain in Moscow. They'd have allowed worship to maintain itself in the various communities of the Soviet Union. And the Jew would have found his soul, and he might have found that his soul can be satisfied within the Soviet Union. But man doesn't live by bread alone. It's not by power always, and not by economic prosperity, but by the spirit that man prevails. And the Soviet, because of their inheritance of anti-Semitism, because of their short-sightedness, did not allow the Jewish soul its freedom. And as a result, even the third generation has a deep sense of being outside, of being insecure. And allow a single event like 67 to come along, and suddenly you find these young people looking, seeking to escape, to find a place where they can breathe more easily. There you have it. I doubt that the Soviet Union can purge itself of this kind of racism. It's been part of Russian life for the centuries. I doubt that all Jews will be allowed to escape, or even all those who want to leave will be allowed to leave. Inevitably, some who remain will suffer because of the anger, with the frustration of the Soviet reaction. Already there is evidence that though a few thousand have escaped, many young Jews are being denied admission to universities. Many Jews are being denied placement in the advanced academies. Many are being pushed and shoved hither and yon where perhaps 10 years ago they would not have been. The Soviet is the Russian bear. And the Russian bear can be a very angry, irritable animal. The problem is a difficult one. How to get the Jews out into pressure for it, at the same time protect as best we can from the outside the survival of those who cannot or will not or do not make application to leave. For those who want desperately to assimilate. For there will be a Russian Council for Judaism, quite as much as there's been an American Council for Judaism. What's for it then? I suspect for us a recognition that those who are coming out are expecting far more of Israel or of American Jewry, wherever they settle, than perhaps we can present them. Where will we give a Mikhail Zand the intense parallel, the parallel to the intensity of his love, of his thirst for Jewish knowledge and Jewish education? Where will we give Roman Rutman a sense of the freedom that the state represents, not only the narrow needs of a particular government, but the broader needs of its citizens and of all mankind? Where will these men find their peace among us, these men and these women? We've already read of some of the difficulties of adjustment in Israel of these Russian emigres. To this point, the adjustments have been economic. They are sophisticated, highly trained people suddenly thrown into society which is not as advanced as theirs. But there's also a spiritual gap. The thirst needs to be slackened. And I sometimes worry that the historical image of Uriel da Costa may not rise again among us. Uriel da Costa was a Marano, third or fourth generation Marano, who found the Bible, who read the Bible, who believed the Bible, who sought freedom from Catholic Portugal in freer Amsterdam, who applied to the Jewish community in Amsterdam for readmission into the fold, who was readmitted to the fold, and who found that the congregation in Amsterdam was as closed-minded and as unbiblical as many whom he had left behind in Portugal. He died a suicide, unable to find in the land the place of freedom, the sense of freedom, the sense of justice, of humanity, the love of the biblical truths which informed his soul. These people place an obligation upon us, not only to do what we can to write the letters, to attend the rallies, to hoist high the placards, but to provide for them a reception, a community, where their thirst, when it is legitimate, for knowledge, for justice, for freedom, for an intense, expansive, vigorous, enlightened Jewish way of life, can be met and can be slackened. Amen.